Robert Reynolds.
Thank you. Rabbi Groig, put you a little bit through a Socratic reprise of the first year of law school. And I would like to not do it Socratically, I don't teach Socratically, but at least give you some other reminders of the first year of law school. Many of you may have remembered from your first year of contracts, two old chestnuts. I don't know if they're famous cases in practice, but they are certainly famous cases in legal academia. One is Mills versus Wyman, and the other is Webb versus McGowan. And generations of law students have been asked to try to reconcile these two cases. Quite briefly, without going through the whole exercise, if you remember, Mills versus Wyman involved a member of the military in the early part of the 19th century who was taken in by a family and was given food and shelter. The person eventually died, and the parents promised to pay compensation for the services that were rendered. And when the parent reneged on the commitments and was sued for breach of contract, the court ruled that the promise to pay for the support was unenforceable because of the old past consideration doctrine. The benefit had already been received when the promise was made, and therefore there was, even though there was a moral obligation, that was instituted by law to make it an enforceable contract. That is a Massachusetts case from the early 19th century. And then we come to a later case, Webb versus McGowan. I think it may have been a Georgia case, I don't remember the state, which involved someone, a worker who was throwing out very heavy logs from the second floor of a barn. And lo and behold, right as he's about to release a big heavy log, the boss is walking by, and the worker did not seize the opportunity just to let go. But the worker, as it were, held on to the log, fell off the roof with the weight of the log on him, suffered very serious personal injury. Employer promised to take care of the worker for the rest of his life. Employer did so until the employer died. The estate refused to continue the payments. A suit was brought for breach of contract, and Webb versus McGowan essentially did recognize the legal enforceability of the contract on the grounds that the moral obligation was a sufficient consideration for the promise to pay. What we see in these two cases, of course, is we do see the precarious position of the common law with regard to the rights of rescuers, even when they suffer serious personal injury. Mills versus Wyman went so far as to say that even if a contract was made, it would not be enforceable. Webb versus McGowan does recognize the enforceability of a contract, but minus a contract, there wouldn't necessarily be any entitlement to compensation had the contract not have been made. And what I want to do is very briefly, just a few basic fundamental principles here, to outline, number one, the right of self-defense, number two, the duties of third parties to intervene to protect people, number three, their rights to compensation for their expenses, reimbursement, and damage and injury, and number four, the tort liability of persons, as it were, who are engaged in the act of rescue, whether they're rescuing themselves or rescuing others, if in the course of their rescue they commit tortious injury to person or property, will they be liable for the damages that they commit, etc. Now, many of you may have seen the very last Seinfeld, I didn't see it myself, but I've heard what it was about, in which Jerry and his friends wind up in prison. And that is because of the statute, the unique statute that Vermont has that imposes a statutory duty to rescue or intervene. And if one does not rescue or intervene, there could be a fine and even imprisonment. But as all of us know, that the classical understanding of the Good Samaritan under common law was there was no duty to intervene. Not only that, but if one does intervene, and something goes wrong, there could be liability for negligence or misfeasance or malpractice or whatever it is. Lately, I remember there was a My Turn column in Newsweek a few years ago where a young intern who had recently graduated from medical school stopped at the scene of an accident to render emergency medical assistance, and he was very proud of himself because this was the first time he had really saved somebody's life. And when he got back to the hospital and he told his attending physician about the very good deed that he did, simply stopping at the side of the road to save someone's life, his attending physician was incredulous. He says, you know, you are absolutely crazy. Number one, our hospital malpractice insurance might not have covered roadside stops. you absolutely should not have stopped because you may have incurred tremendous liability. And needless to say, the physician was very devastated. Here he had graduated medical school, hoping to enter a helping profession, and now he's told that he should not render emergency medical assistance simply because of potential tort liability in the event of malpractice or if something had gone wrong, whether it would be truly malpractice or it'd simply be an allegation of malpractice. It could certainly hurt his reputation, bankrupt him, and impose liability on his employer as well. We do know that in many states there are indeed Good Samaritan statutes that at least create an immunity from tort liability. But the classical common law rule was, as articulated very clearly by Oliver Wendell Holmes in his famous book, The Common Law, written before he became a judge even in Massachusetts. In fact, I believe that Holmes was torn between a career in philosophy and a career in law. And he had made a personal commitment to himself that if he could not produce a worthy and significant work on legal scholarship before the age of 40, he would switch to philosophy. So indeed, the common law was produced in his 40th year, and that kind of kept him in the legal profession. But as Justice Holmes said, or as Oliver Wendell Holmes, the practicing attorney, wrote, the common law system, which is predicated so much on autonomy and individuality, as opposed to a communitarian system of ethics, basically says, as long as you don't hurt anybody, as long as you remain in your own private little orbit, you know, the world can go to hell, you have no responsibilities towards enhancing the welfare of the world, you have no duties at all to intervene, to alleviate another person's suffering, just keep away and you will be okay. And this notion of the individuality, it's very interesting because, you know, within legal academia, there's a whole movement, feminist jurisprudence and critical legal studies, and perhaps you may have read about the different dissensions that are going on in law schools and in law school faculties. This is tearing many faculties apart. I know at Harvard Law School a few years ago, a number of very eminent traditional professors actually left the school because they couldn't stand being in the same room with the feminist jurisprudence people and the critical legal studies people who didn't even believe law. And so they were anti-law as an institution, and the question is, why are they teaching in law school? It was all debate that has subsided a little bit in legal academia. But the feminist jurisprudence movement makes a number of points, and they make a point that the Anglo-American legal system is primarily predicated on what you might call masculine ideas. And again, we're using stereotypes here, but this is how, you know, scholars do use stereotypes simply because that's how we characterize reality with oversimplifications. But the idea is that the male model is premised on autonomy, control, and individuality, as opposed to a more feminist approach, which is said to deal with the values of community, solidarity, togetherness, and intervention. Thus, for example, to take a trivial example from everyday life, it is well known that men do not like to stop and ask directions. And part of that is because it is a surrender of our autonomy and control to show that we need somebody else's help. So, you know, obviously if we've been traveling for 2 or 3 hours, eventually we break down. But until we reach that point, we try to remain firm. On the other hand, I know when I go with my wife on a trip, you know, we're just coming out of the driveway and she says, let's stop and ask directions to be sure we know where we're going. So there are many, many reasons for this. And I think one of the legitimate points that feminist jurisprudence has made, I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff that I think is frankly flawed and illegitimate, but one of their points is that indeed, if we identify the male tendency with one of autonomy, individuality, and self-control, that would explain a whole bunch of things, such as the classic common law rule that there's no duty to intervene, the notion that there might be tort liability for a good faith intervention, absence a Good Samaritan statute of immunity, or the like. And in this sense, it is a society which is predicated on, as Holmes identified, a rugged individualism, autonomy, and control, in which the only demand society has is thou shalt not hurt another, but you have no particular obligation to help. In this sense, Jewish law, although there are many, many parallels to the secular system, there are also some very, very distinct duties in which it is not enough merely not to harm another, but there are certain affirmative obligations to render assistance,
to alleviate dangers, to extricate people who would otherwise be threatened. Now, I don't want to overstate this, because it is very, very clear that by and large, failure to rescue is not rendered a criminal offense, so to speak. In other words, it's not the same as murder. My failure to intervene generally does not subject me to the penalties for active homicide. So even Jewish law recognizes that there are distinctions between harming somebody and interest them. But certainly in the realm of mitzvah, divine commandments, there are indeed divine commandments. Ultimately, God holds us accountable for our failure to rescue and extricate, as well as the active harm that we do. That's why, interestingly enough, there are some scholars that have said that although Jewish law is not feminist in the conventional way that that term is understood, that Jewish law does embody some of the philosophical underpinnings of what might be called feminist jurisprudence in its greater orientation towards communal responsibility and the mutuality that we owe each other as part of the human and certainly part of the Jewish fellowship. So let me just cite a few basic halachic sources. And again, some of these might be very familiar to you regarding these various duties. First, as a general matter, although it's not directly relevant to our topic, there is a commandment in the Torah that if somebody has a flat roof in which people could climb up on the roof and fall off, there is a halachic obligation to construct a fence around that roof so that people will not be endangered by the use of that roof. That is a mitzvah of called ma'akeh, building a fence around the roof. And Maimonides, based on many Talmudic passages, says that this is a much more general principle. It is not merely a specific law regarding building a fence around a roof, but rather there's an obligation on a person to correct any type of danger that exists under his control and possession to make it safe. That would include, for example, if you have a swimming pool, to drain out the water or cover it or create a situation where people will not fall in. Similar a little bit to the tort liability that is imposed under the old attractive nuisance idea. But there is an affirmative obligation to eliminate dangers, and indeed, one can get into another debate, would halacha for that reason require a certain measure of gun control or the like? But there is a law, and Maimonides codifies it, interestingly enough, in the section of his code that are called the laws of murderers and preservation of life. So Maimonides seems to create a symmetry, and that is, one who allows dangerous instrumentalities to remain under his control, in which people are needlessly exposed, on some level that is connected to the notion of murder. Now, the symmetry is not complete. Nobody's going to say that I can be put to death because I failed to cover up my swimming pool. So the symmetry is not complete there. But Maimonides does consider it, based on the Talmudic interpretation, as, in some spiritual way, it is a form of murder. Now, that requirement, which, by the way, also means, just as one is obligated to remove dangers that others are exposed to, one himself is not allowed to engage in unreasonably dangerous behavior. So this gets into a whole discussion. Is a halachically committed to smoke or whatever it is? That's a whole complicated discussion. But there is a concept. One does not enter into unreasonably dangerous behaviors because of this law. One cannot even waive the right. Because just as one cannot commit suicide, one cannot necessarily expose themselves to dangers. And Rabbi Greg mentioned the issue of the kidney, and the halacha does say that I'm not obligated, basically, to endanger my life even to save another person. However, in the kidney situation, many would permit that decision to be made knowingly and intelligently, but given the fact that minors are not capable of making those decisions, we then get into the question of parental rights. So that's really point number one, the duty to remove dangers to oneself and to the public at large, and that is subsumed under the mitzvah of ma'akeh, the commandment of building a fence around one's roof. Now, rule number two is a halachic principle that became very notorious and very, although the halakhic principle is not controversial per se, but it got bad press in the aftermath of the Rabin assassination, and many have heard of this Hebrew term. If you remember, Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated a few years ago, and the assassin, Yigal Amir, stated that he assassinated Rabin because Rabin was a rodef, a rodef. Rodef is a pursuer. And as I say, those who are invoking rodef as a justification for political assassination have discredited a very fine halacha. It's a very fine principle of Jewish law that is absolutely a binding Jewish law. And that is, there is a rule, and this basically parallels the rules of self-defense in many ways, that one whose life is being endangered by an external threat is permitted to kill the person that is making that threat. There are going to be many rules we'll talk about in a moment. And this is encapsulated in the very pithy dictum, Haba lahargecha hashkein baharog lo, one who is coming to kill you, you are permitted to kill first. You don't turn the other cheek. One is permitted to use even lethal violence in order to preserve their life. That person is called a rodef, the pursuer, and one may take that person's life. The source of the law of rodef needs a little bit of explication, because you need a little bit of background. There is, of course, a general principle in Jewish law that the preservation of life supersedes virtually the whole Torah. So, for example, if one's life is in danger because of illness, one is not only permitted but commanded to violate the Shabbat laws and violate the kosher laws and to eat leavened bread on Pesach or to eat on Yom Kippur. So there is a general rule that life takes precedence over virtually the entire Torah. But that alone would not justify the use of lethal force in killing another human being. And the reason that is so is because there are three basic exceptions to the rule that the preservation of human life overrides. And that is, it does not apply to idolatry, or in more general terms, renunciation of one's faith. So for example, if someone goes over to you and says, renounce the Torah, worship this idol, become a Christian, or I will kill you, a Jew does have a very difficult duty of martyrdom, to give up their life rather than renouncing their belief in God and in God's Torah. That's category number one. Category number two is sexual offenses, including adultery and incest, that if someone goes over to a man and says, give up your life, I'm sorry, rape this woman or be with this woman, or I will kill you, one must give up their life. I'm specifically using the example of a man. Whether a woman would have to give up her life is a whole difficult halachic question. And number three, if I go over to you and I say, kill that person or I'll kill you, the halacha is very clear. You are not allowed to kill an innocent person to save your own life. And although for the first two categories, for idolatry and for sexual offenses, the Talmud has verses which show that they trump saving of a life, for this third category, there is no reason to invoke a verse. It is a matter of elementary common sense, the Talmud says, because who says your blood is any redder than his blood? Meaning, if the whole justification for committing a sin is the saving of a life, where the commission of that sin is taking a life, why should the taking of somebody else's life be justified on the grounds that it's saving your life? Who says your life is any better? Well, you might say, well, that's not so logical. What if my life is better? Or the guy's a bum, you know. But basically, the halakha creates an absolute presumption, that one cannot make the judgments of whose life is intrinsically more significant. It may be that, you know, you're 99% sure, but you might be wrong. Or it may be, in a sense, if life is considered to be of infinite value, then by definition, qualitative assessments are simply impossible, because one person might be 1,000 times infinity, another person might be 100 times infinity. Infinity is infinity, and once you start making a judgment, then all life has been reduced to comparative worth rather than infinite value. But be it as it may, the halacha itself basically says, the general rule is, you can't take a life to preserve a life. Now, this has an application in many, many ways. For example, this is without that, I don't want to get into too much because it's not my topic, but for example, this is an issue regarding heart transplants, right? What is the problem? One of the reasons why there are halachic issues in the removal of organs, that is, that generally speaking, a heart must be removed while it's still beating and the blood is circulating, although there may have been a clinical diagnosis of brain death. But through respiration and oxygen being supplied, the heart muscle is still beating. Now, there is a whole debate in halacha, what is the definition of death? If the person is dead, there's no problem in removing the heart from a cadaver, because you're doing it to save another life. But if the person is alive, and again, as I say, that's a debate in halachic sources, but if the person is alive, all right, he's comatose, he's brain dead, there's no chance of any recovery, the person's going to live a very short time anyway, and with the heart transplant, by removing the heart and giving it to somebody else, we could give a person many years of life, halacha would still say, you can't murder A to save B. Simply because even though A's life is clearly, based on the way we perceive it, of far less value than B's life, you can't kill A to save B. Now, having said that, therefore, what this teaches us is that the law of Rodef is definitionally not predicated on the general rule that to save a life you could commit sin, because here the sin that you're committing is the sin of murder. You normally cannot commit murder to save your life. But the chiddush, the innovation of the law of Rodef is that if I go over to you and I say, kill him or I'll kill you, you can't kill him, but you kill me. Meaning to say, the aggressor, as it were, by the very act of making that aggression, has, as it were, forfeited his life and may therefore be eliminated. So the point is, it is not within the general parameters of pikuach nefesh, rather it's a unique privilege, as it were, of self-defense. The origin of it, there are a number of different sources in the Bible which are interpreted in the Talmud to give this right of self-defense. One of them is the passage in Exodus that talks about you come home at night and you encounter a burglar who has entered your home. And the halacha basically does allow you, in cases where, unless you know for sure the burglar will not harm you, that you are allowed to kill the burglar, because the assumption is that he's coming in with the assumption he will not encounter resistance. If he encounters resistance, he is prepared to kill, and therefore you may take his life, considering him a rodef. Although it's very interesting yes? Yeah. I'm sorry, yeah. Okay, I'm sorry, and I apologize. Rodef. Okay, again, the word halacha is simply a Hebrew word that means Jewish law. So we use the word halacha over and over again. Literally, it means the path that one walks on. So every Jewish law principle is called a halachic principle. The term rodef is a Hebrew word called a pursuer, and that is the prototype of the situation where one is endangering the life of another, and therefore one who is pursuing someone else, the one that is being pursued, has the right to use lethal force to eliminate that threat. That is the law of rodef, the law of the pursuer. Yes, yeah, I apologize. Now, the thing is this. Therefore, the paradigm of the burglar is one of the primary biblical sources for the law of pursuer. Habal ha-hagacha, he who comes to kill you, hashkein v'haroglo, you may kill him first. Now, the law of the pursuer is not limited to the person who is actually threatened. It does permit third-party intervention as well. So if A is threatening B with lethal force, the privilege of using lethal force to counteract that threat is not limited to B, who is actually being threatened. It does allow third-party intervention. C is permitted to intervene in order to save A's life. That's one aspect of it. A second aspect of it, and this is quite logical, is that lethal force is permitted only if there is no apparent alternative that will circumvent the need to use that lethal force. So thus, if one is capable of maiming or injuring or using a degree of force that is less than the taking of a life, one would be halachically obligated to use that magnitude of lesser force. And if one used excessive force, when lesser force would have been sufficient to disable the threat. One could be criminally culpable even for homicide, even for murder, by using this excessive force. At the same time, however, halacha recognizes, as does secular law, the commonsensical situation that it is very difficult to gauge what exactly needs to be done, and the situation is not judged by the hindsight. I mean, let's say, for example, somebody enters my house and has a toy pistol in their hand, and because it's dark, I thought it was a real gun, and as a result, I used lethal force, when in fact there was no threat at all. Obviously, the paradigm of self-defense, or even third-party, is not predicated on the objective realities as they are, but it's predicated on what it was reasonable for a person to assume they are faced with that situation. So there's balance here. That if it was apparent that less than lethal force, an example would be, the guy's leaving the house, and I shoot him from the back. Clearly, there would be no justification of self-defense if the criminal is already in retreat. So under those circumstances, indeed, there could be liability for the use of excessive force. Yeah.
What about the possibility of flight? You could have averted the threat by fleeing.
Yes, that's very interesting. It seems that Jewish law, although it doesn't phrase it quite this way, it seems that Jewish law does subscribe to a notion that is akin to the idea that a person's home is their castle, meaning to say that at least within the confines of the home, there is no duty to retreat. Now, had it been, let's say, in the streets or somewhere else other than the home, including perhaps a business, halacha, Jewish law, might very well consider the obligations to retreat. It's interesting that the whole paradigm of the Torah's case of the sudden burglar does not seem to require any notion of getting out of there. So this is our basic category, again, called rogef. It permits the use of lethal force to repel a supposed lethal threat, either by the victim himself or by a third-party intervention. It does require using no more force than is apparently necessary to repel the threat, but it does allow the reasonable apprehensions of the person to be taken into account. There's a very interesting rule in the Mishnah about this, which one would question whether it applies to the situation. Let's say a person comes home at night, and they discover their parents is the burglar who is going to witness. Are they allowed to their parents if the parent is prepared to use this again? The Talmud rules that since it is so inconceivable that a parent would inflict that bodily harm on a child, the child is not allowed to assume that his life is threatened. Therefore, if the child were to kill the parents on the grounds of self-defense, the defense would not be sustained, and the child could be guilty of the criminal homicide. Conversely, the halacha is that if a parent comes home and finds a child engaged in that burglary, the parent is entitled to make the judgment that the child would be guilty, and therefore a self-defense argument would be available. Now, these are rules of presumption. I mean, certainly in the real world, if such a threat does exist, it has to be taken into account. I mean, parents have killed children, children have killed parents. Unfortunately, it has gone both ways. I think Marvin Gaye was killed by his father. Again, it was an accident, but of course, he pulled out a gun, and it was an act. He didn't intend to kill him, but he did intend to shoot him. So these things happen. I think that these rules of Jewish law are clearly in the nature of maybe standard operating presumptions, which would certainly vary with the facts of any given case. But it is interesting, and it seems to be illustrative of a famous old Yiddish saying that one parent can take care of 10 children, but somehow 10 children cannot take care of one parent. It kind of reflects the idea that the love of a parent towards a child is often much stronger than the love of a child towards a parent. Right, so these are the basic rules of rogef, and again, just as the law of self-defense, it is difficult to apply in practice what's excessive force, etc. But the basic principles are going to be fairly clear. Now, under Jewish law, if I'm a third-party bystander, not only am I permitted to intervene to repel that threat to another person, but as I indicated, under Jewish law, I am required to engage in that intervention, meaning there is a duty to rescue under Jewish law. And this is actually a biblical commandment that is expressed both in terms of a positive commandment and a negative commandment. The negative commandment, which is a very well-known verse, appears in Leviticus chapter 19, and it basically says, do not stand idly by your friend's or your neighbor's blood. Very, very important rule. I mean, that is the rule that overrules, or at least denies, the notion that there's no duty to intervene. I have a duty to intervene, to certainly save the life of another person, and indeed, even if it's not a question of life and death, if they would suffer financial loss that I could avert, I have the responsibility to do what I can. Now, it is true that Jewish law does say, as I indicated in the beginning of my remarks, that there is no obligation to put your own life at risk. That is absolutely the case. There is no obligation to save another. But to the degree that I could rescue by calling 911, or I could rescue by doing something that would not put me in the zone of danger, it's clear that Jewish law says not only are you permitted to intervene, but in fact you are obligated to intervene. Otherwise you are guilty of the negative commandment of standing idly by your friend's blood, which is considered, as Maimonides writes, to be accessory to murder, although there is no criminal liability per se. So Jewish law does not go as far as the state of Vermont to impose a penalty for a failure to rescue, but it clearly is an offense under Jewish law. Now, let's imagine that the only way you could rescue someone is by spending a certain amount of money. Let's imagine, for example, that somebody is trapped in some place and you would have to hire a crew to get them out, and you have to incur expenditures in your rescue attempts. There are two questions here. Number one, does the duty of rescue require the expenditure of funds, or is it only a personal obligation? That's number one. Number two, if the duty of rescue does require the expenditure of funds, and the rescuer, in fulfillment of that duty, expends them, is the rescuer entitled to reimbursement? What if the rescuer, in the middle of his rescue, suffers personal injuries? Is the rescuer entitled to any type of compensation for that rescue effort? So let's just take these questions very briefly, and again, time does not permit a full consideration of all of the source materials, but I just want to give the basic principles that seem to emerge. Number one, must money be spent when there is a duty to rescue? The Talmud clearly indicates money must be spent. In fact, the Talmud points out that the imperative of not standing idly by your friend's blood is not only a personal obligation, but it even requires the expenditure of funds and even the foregoing of income and the like. Now the question, yes,
does the Talmud make any distinction between the amount of funds, the blessing, all of one's funds is bankrupt?
Yeah, that's the next point, right.
Oh,
okay. Yes, that's very good.
If you keep using the word friends, is there a distinction between friends and strangers?
Okay, again, it's a very good question, and this points up to the ambiguities and inadequacies, really, of English translations. The word in Hebrew is re'echa, which is usually translated as either friend or neighbor. But in Jewish law, it absolutely does not depend if it's somebody you know or somebody you don't know. These are obligations. Based on the ideal that to every human being, I should have a relationship of regarding them as my friend. So I'm using the word friend or neighbor because that is commonly how the biblical phrase is, like love your neighbor as yourself, etc., but it really refers to our interrelationship as a whole. So it's just a question of ambiguity of translation. Now, so the Talmud clearly indicates that the obligation of rescue does entail financial, and I'll discuss reimbursement in a moment, but it doesn't indicate how much of a financial commitment, your question, do I have to lay out. So here, the commentaries approach it based on a general distinction in Jewish law between a positive commandment. Positive commandments are those commandments where the Torah says, thou shalt do something, an affirmative action, and negative commandment where the Torah says, thou shalt not do something, right? So thou shalt not steal, is called a negative commandment. Thou shalt recite, you know, certain prayers, the meaning of that's a positive commandment. Now, the halakha says the following. The halakha says that if I'm unable to do a positive commandment, unless I give up some of my money, I am not obligated to spend more than one-fifth of my net worth in attempting to do a positive commandment. I mean, let's assume, for example, you know, the price of the phylacteries that people wear can sometimes be very expensive. So let's assume that I'm in Russia, or I'm in Cuba, let's say, and I can't get a kosher pair of tefillin, or I can't get a mezuzah for my house unless I spend more than one-fifth of my net worth. So Jewish law says, if you got to spend more than one-fifth of your net worth, you are exempt from the duty of complying with that positive commandment. Right? That's a principle of Jewish law. And hopefully, there'll be a time when you'll either be richer or the commodity will be cheaper, and then you'll do it. But as long as it's going to cost you more than one-fifth, you are exempt.
Pretty unrealistic, isn't it? I don't think the person
who knows his or her net worth. Well, many of us in academia are probably insolvent. We may not have a net worth.
I don't know what one-fifth.
Well, it would be a question that would need to be elaborated upon, simply because, you know, what do you include? After all, a person may have a home, and the home might be heavily mortgaged, and their equity in the home might be relatively insignificant. Basically, net worth does not simply mean your assets, but it would mean your assets over and above your liabilities. That's correct. So there would have to be a calculation. As I say, it's fairly rare that we are confronted, at least in modern Western societies, that we're confronted with that type of dilemma. Tefillin have not gotten quite that expensive for these, but this is what halacha says. Halacha does have this one fifth. Now, let's go back the other way. Let's assume that I live in a society where I cannot get kosher food. There's the only food that is available is non-kosher food. And I spend an exorbitant amount of money under Jewish law, since eating non-kosher food is a negative commandment. Thou shalt not eat a pig or whatever it is. A Jew must be willing to give away all of their fortune. You have to, even if a person destitute, a person would have to spend all of that money before they transgress the negative. Now, which means to say, if even spending all of their money, they will not be able to get kosher food, at that point, if their life is threatened because they'll starve to death, they of course can eat non-kosher food because their life is threatened. But before one can invoke the fact that if I don't eat this, I will die, the person has to be willing to make the lesser of us of giving up all of their money. Yeah.
Yeah. But I know there are people out there who don't just require charity, but require such a bad as they would die.
Yeah. Your point really depends on a point that I'm going to make, and that is the following. The obligation of saving people whose lives are in danger is predicated on a negative commandment. Thou shalt not stand idly by your neighbor's blood. Now, if we accept this and we classify it as the standard negative commandment, that would indicate the duty of financial expenditure would actually be my entire net worth. Now again, I'll get to the reimbursement in a moment, but at least initially, simply because this would fall under the category of the negative commandment. And indeed, there are some opinions that do take the position that the obligation and duty of bless you is so significant that at least initially, subject to a reimbursement right, one must give up all of their net worth. The other position says that since the duty to rescue is a duty of commission, and therefore the failure to rescue is a sin of omission, it is really on the side of the active action versus passive, and therefore the one-fifth would apply. So there is in Jewish law a controversy which does not have a definitive resolution, because there are different opinions of great authority that express both sides, whether the duty of expenditure is subject to the 20% cap, or the duty of expenditure is subject to an unlimited cap. Now the question you raised is, well, what does that mean? All of us are aware of people who need life-saving operations, you know, need a kidney, you need heart transplant, who will die unless $1 million are raised. Does that mean that I have to bankrupt myself? I mean, what do I get? For the first person who comes to my door? And what's going to happen to the second person? And what's going to happen to my family? Well, here we get into a very subtle point, which is not developed very well, but it seems to be apparent, and that is, when you are dealing with chronic, systemic problems, they become communal problems more than individual problems. So yes, the community of which I am a part is obligated to allocate the resources to extricate people from those situations, but that does not necessarily mean I as an individual have to do it when there is a community that in which I can assume the burden along with others. That is different than the imminent situation where I'm the only one there, then initially I would have to use those expenditures. So you have to differentiate between situations that are susceptible to communal involvement and situations where I'm the only guy there, and therefore I'm obligated to ask. All right, so we then come to the issue of the following. If, in fact, there is a duty to expend funds, what about my right of reimbursement? Do I get reimbursed? What would Jewish law say about Mills versus Wyman, or Webb versus McGowan, in which services were rendered which saved somebody's life? Is there an entitlement to compensation? What if the person didn't want to be saved? What if I stopped somebody from committing suicide? And I got injured in the process, or I didn't get injured in the process. Could they sue me for wrongful life? As you know, the whole controversy in tort law about people who didn't want to live, or whatever, or they were born from botched abortions, or whatever it is. Are there causes of action because one's life was saved? So here, as you know, in common law, the way some of these questions were answered, because, for example, let's take emergency medical services that are rendered to an unconscious patient. Generally speaking, the physician could send a bill if he customarily charges for services. And common law had a great deal of problems in trying to figure out a theory of liability. You know, it's one thing if I go into a doctor's office and I'm conscious, and the doctor renders services to me, and then sends me a bill, and I say, who agreed to pay? Why do I have to pay? I didn't say I was going to pay you. Well, it's understood, though, if you voluntarily and intentionally receive professional services, which are customarily rendered for compensation. So this is what is called a contract implied in fact. You don't have to say the words, it's understood. But that theory doesn't really work when a person was unconscious. Even if the person is very grateful that they're alive, they could say, well, thank you very much for saving my life, but I didn't agree to pay you, and there was nothing implicit in my behavior that said, I agree to pay you. So as you know, I got up initially by making up a term called a contract implied in law, which really is a meaningless term because there was no contract, but we'll just say contract implied in law. And the more progressive way of describing it would be unjust enrichment, restitution, or the like, reasonable value of services, simply because it is unjust and unfair for you to benefit from services that are customarily rendered non-gratuitously that are to your benefit without paying for them. So the old common law had to make believe it was a contract theory. Today, most courts don't use the contract vocabulary. They simply talk about unjust enrichment and restitution. Well, there are some similar principles in halakha, although once again, the terminology is not the same. The rescuer does have the right to sue the rescued party to recover the money that he expended. And this is true even if the victim protests, even if the victim wishes not to be rescued, and even if the victim later refuses to compensate the rescuer. There is an entitlement for reimbursement of expenses. However, what is interesting, and again, on a human level, somewhat difficult, is that if the rescuer suffers damages, such as personal injury, let's take Webb versus McGowan is a good example. A rescuer suffers damages in the course of trying to do the rescue. The rescuer may, in fact, find himself with no claim against the rescued, because under Jewish tort law, liability for tort rests on the tortfeasor. So, for example, if I try to save you and I get injured by the criminal, I certainly have a tort action against the criminal, but that does not translate into any type of action against the benefited party, simply because the benefited party was not a contributor in any way to the injuries that I suffered. So Jewish law seems to have a cap which limits recovery to out-of-pocket expenditure and perhaps a certain amount of recovery for lost wages. That might be actually a significant recovery, but it would not compensate for loss of limb or the like, because the relatively limited scope of tort liability would not shift that liability to the rescued party. Yeah. Yes. So the question is what?
When you're injured, is there a claim for damages under
those circumstances? No. Your argument is because the danger was created by the victim.
Right.
Yeah. It's a good point, but Jewish law has, again, my brother has spoken about this too, Jewish law has some very limited rules regarding causation and proximate cause, which in effect, even in such a case, not support liability, to the suicide person. It really goes back to issues of direct causation and the like, which are very, very limited. So Jewish law would affect... Therefore, that in a Webb versus McGowan case, let's go back to Mills versus Wyman and Webb versus McGowan. Mills versus Wyman, we do have out-of-pocket expenditures in food and lodging. Jewish law might regard that as recoverable, even in the absence of a contract. And ironically, the personal injuries of Webb versus McGowan might not be recoverable. The Jewish law might actually reverse the holdings of those two cases. Again, it's not so clear because Mills versus Wyman, the problem was, if you remember, the services were not rendered to the parent, the services were rendered to an adult child. So it may very well be that the parent has no obligation whatsoever. But at least vis-a-vis, let's say, a claim against the son, Jewish law might very well regard there as an enforceable claim against the son. But again, it does not articulate it in terms of a contract theory. But it seems to be a theory akin to unjust enrichment, being the beneficiary of expenditures that were made on your behalf. Now, the final issue I want to discuss is a fascinating issue, and that is the issue of the tort liability of the rescuer. In other words, we discussed that if the rescuer is injured, he only has a limited right of recourse against the rescued party. But what about if the rescuer commits tortious activities as part of his rescue efforts, either inadvertently or as part of the rescue attempt, will he be liable in tort? So we have to make a very simple distinction. Obviously, vis-a-vis any tortious intervention against the aggressor, there will clearly be no liability if the magnitude of that force was justified. Meaning to say, if the threat could only be repelled by lethal force, and I kill him, I'm obviously not liable for killing them. That's what the law of Rodafe, the law of the pursuer, says, right? So that's not our issue. Or, if I maimed him, because that was the level of force that was sufficient, I will not be liable for maiming him. I mean, that's the definition of a privileged battery, right? The right of self-defense or third-party intervention will mean, by definition, there will be immunity from liability. But the question of tort liability presents itself when a third party's property or person was damaged. Let me give an example. I'm in a hotel room here, and I'm looking down at the street, and I see that A is holding up B by gunpoint. And I see that B's life is here. So I take a Ming vase, right, 9th century Ming vase, from the hotel lobby, or from my hotel room, and I simply throw it down on the aggressor's head. The aggressor gets knocked down, and I've alleviated the threat in a reasonable manner without using lethal force, but I smashed this vase that's worth $100,000. Now, was I supposed to do what I did? Well, yeah, there was nothing cheaper around. It is perfectly legitimate for me to break someone's property in order to save a person from that from death. The question becomes, though, what is my tort liability? if I save somebody by the utilization of someone else's property and that property is destroyed? Or what if the victim himself uses the Ming vase to save his life? Will he incur liability? So again, the Talmud discusses this, and again, time does not allow a full consideration of the Talmudic passages, but I just want to mention the rulings as they are codified in Maimonides' code, because this is a very interesting example of a halachic rule that in effect is modified in the interests of greater societal encouragement of interveners. And that is, halacha says, that if, let's take my third party case, that if a third party takes the Ming vase and drops it on the head of the aggressor, although under strict principles of Jewish law, he should certainly be liable to pay for those damages, which is an interesting point, because Jewish law takes the position, in effect, Jewish law takes the position that even if you are privileged to destroy that property, that should not exonerate you from compensation. Two different things. There is a mitzvah, there is a commandment to do what you can to save a life, but you still got to pay for the damage. However, through a special rabbinic enactment, they exonerated the rescuer from tort liability. Reason? In order to encourage people to engage in rescue attempts. Because if I know that if I break that Ming vase, I'm going to have to pay $200,000, I'm not going to bother. I'll either call 911 or simply, as Kimmy Genovese faced, simply don't do anything at all. So as an encouragement to facilitate rescue efforts, third parties are exonerated from tort liability for tortious acts that are committed as part of the rescue attempt.
Doesn't a hotel also have an obligation to not stand by while this person was dying and spend at least up to 5% of his net worth, which is probably more than?
Yeah, well, literally 20%, not 5%. Yeah, one-fifth. Yeah, but keep in mind that based on what we said, they themselves are entitled to reimbursement. In other words, you're correct, they're obligated to let them, but they're entitled to be compensated for it, right? So, that's not true. In other words, if you remember the rule that I indicated, when a rescuer incurs financial losses, out-of-pocket expenses. The loss of the Ming vase is not a pocket expense. They are entitled to reimbursement. So the fact that the hotel has an obligation wouldn't deprive them of their recovery. So therefore, under the laws of logic, it should be, therefore, that the third party who drops the vase should have to pay the hotel, because the hotel would have been able to get those expenditures from the rescuer had they used it in saving the rescuer. So the halacha says over here, Maimonides codifies, that in order to encourage hatsala, in order to encourage intervention, there is an immunity from tort liability. This is, of course, a direct parallel to many of the Good Samaritan statutes that attempt to immunize the intervener from tort liability in the commission of a good faith rescue. Interestingly enough, however, Maimonides says, if the victim rescued himself by breaking the Ming vase, the victim would have to pay. Why is that? Presumably, although he doesn't say it specifically, but presumably the concept is that since saving your own life is so fundamental to every human being, the threat of tort liability is not likely to be a deterrent. Meaning, you're going to save yourself whether you're liable or you're not liable. Consequently, there is no need to disturb the normal allocation of legal liability. It is only the third party that needs the encouragement and not the victim himself. So ironically, therefore, if you need the Ming vase to be dropped, you should gesture to your companion to do so. If you do it yourself, there'll be a certain bill that you will have to pay. Right, now, one final point I just want to discuss. This concept of the pursuer, the rodef, the one that is threatening my life, halacha has some very interesting expansions of this idea. That number one, the rodef does not have to be a conscious human being with malevolent intent to kill me. That's the classical rodef. The guy pulls out a gun and says, I'm going to shoot you or whatever it is. A rodef, first of all, in Maimonides' own formulation, it's a famous passage, he discusses, as you know, Jewish law generally does not regard abortion as murder per se, but Jewish law in its traditional sense certainly regards the killing of a fetus as a violation of the Torah. But the classic instance of when one is allowed and even commanded to abort a fetus is when the conclusion of the pregnancy will endanger the mother's life. And that could be broadly defined as psychological trauma, may be considered life-endangering, and that's how we might analyze certain cases of rape and incest because of the potentially life-threatening devastation that it might be on the mother. But however we define it, which again is a talk for another time, Maimonides needs to addresses this problem. Well, gee, just because the mother's life is in danger, why should that give you a right to kill the fetus? Why do you kill one life to save another? And there are many, many answers, but the answer that Maimonides gives is that since it is the fetus that is the source of the danger to the mother's life, even though the fetus has no malevolent intention, the fetus is a pursuer vis-a-vis the mother, and therefore the law of Rodeth can become activated to permit the termination of the pregnancy. There are many tragic questions. For example, in some cases, a mother might prefer to go the other way around. There were cases, for example, where a woman had advanced cancer and chemotherapy might prolong her life. She was pregnant, but the chemotherapy would either kill the child or result in severe brain damage. The question is, does the mother have the right to decline chemotherapy, although it's very likely she'll die in childbirth? And halacha does permit, in many cases, that type of voluntary martyrdom for the sake of another. But in terms of strict halacha, the fetus is treated as a rodef and may be terminated. Not only a fetus, but indeed we have cases reputedly from the Holocaust, where if you have Jews that are hiding and the Germans are going through the house, and if they find the Jews, they will kill them, and the baby starts crying and gives away the whereabouts of the group. And there were cases where they tried to silence the baby, and the story goes that the babies were smothered. Now, the stories that are said is that it was accidentally and inadvertent, and these are tragic, tragic, horrendous situations that I hope that none of us will ever face. But certainly a case could be made under a strict reading of halacha that if the baby's crying is endangering the whereabouts of a group of people, the baby might halachically be classified as a rodef, and one might be permitted to kill the baby in order to save the lives of everyone else. So the point I'm making simply is that rodef is not limited to the conscious, malevolent pursuer, but the inanimate, not the other, the baby, whether born or unborn, could be a rodef. Finally, Maimonides has a fascinating rule where property might be a rodef. And here, we have an interesting exception to the tort liability rule. Let's go, this is kind of lifeboat ethics here. Let's assume we're all on a boat together, and there's too many people and too much baggage. But we're assuming the boat could stay afloat with people. Let's assume that you have 300 pounds of luggage, and the boat is going to sink if the luggage is more than 250. Okay? So Maimonides has a ruling that if any of the people just takes the luggage, not even his own, he can do what he wants, but he just takes luggage at random, and he throws it overboard, and as a result, saves the people on the boat, Maimonides writes, not only is it a commandment to do so, one is fulfilling the commandment of saving life, but in fact, he is not obligated to pay for the damages that he inflicted on that property, because the surplus baggage is a rodef. It is endangering the boat. Now here, the commentaries make an important point. How do you determine which of the luggage, right? It's 250 pounds are okay. It's the 50 pounds that creates the danger. Well, which 50 pounds is creating the danger? So normally, it would be the last 50 pounds. Meaning to say, if we knew exactly what went in at what time, we would have to allocate the rodef characterization to the last 50, and that would be what would have to be eliminated. However,
the case that Maimonides is talking about is, we don't know, or everything came on at the same time, and or something happened in mid-voyage, which may be excess baggage. In other words, originally 300 was fine, and now we can't do that anymore. Now, the only question you might ask is, well, wait a second here. Maimonides writes that if I throw the stuff off the boat, I don't have to pay damages. Now, the question is, Maimonides ruled before that the exoneration of tort liability only applies to a third party who intervenes, because he needs the incentive. But the actual beneficiary who damages property is going to be liable, because he doesn't need the incentive. So the question is, how come here there's an exoneration of tort liability? Again, the distinction seems to be fairly clear. In the earlier discussion, Maimonides was talking about using a third party's property to extricate someone from a threat. Here, the property is the threat. The property itself is the threat. So the same way I could eliminate a threat by killing a human being and not incurring liability, I could eliminate a threat by destruction of property and I don't incur liability. So here, there is no distinction whether it's a third party that threw the stuff overboard, somehow a Coast Guard ship or something, or whether it was an actual endangered party, because here the property is the Rodef itself, as opposed to the case of the Ming Vase, where the property is not the Rodef, and then we make a distinction between the liability of the person and liability of the third party. So, again, as I say, this gets into many, many other things, lifeboat ethics and the like, but I think it does show that at least on the moral plane, number one, Jewish law does recognize a duty to rescue, and number two, to facilitate and encourage that duty to rescue, there are very significant limitations on tort liability. Where Jewish law does not fully address the problems are that Jewish law does not provide a full compensation for the injuries that a rescuer will suffer in the course, other than giving the rescuer a tort claim against the perpetrator of the tort, which may be ineffective and also wouldn't help in many cases, such as suicide or injuries that are suffered, not because of an injury that the aggressor inflicts, but because of, you know, I jumped off a bridge to rescue you in the water, etc. Jewish law would tend not to give me any enforceable claim on that basis. So thank you. Yeah. Yes.
How would one who wanted to live philosophy without that conflict?
Yeah, well, these are difficult issues. You know, there is both in St. Louis and other cities as well, Jewish courts with biblical basins, Hudson, just, and just more than not the case to be best in for judgment. And the arguments and many opinions, and the cutting qualifications, and a literature interpretation that spans thousands of years, and a din have to evaluate all of the precedents and determine where the weight of authority goes.
I
tell you, on some issues though, it's a little difficult to form shop, because we often don't know how a thing is going to come out. We really don't have an organized system of at least precedents on any of these issues. But you know, I cannot tell you that Jewish law, but I think the options might be somewhat limited. Thank you.